I'd like to start by reading Psalm 1. It's short, and if you want to, follow along. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked. They're like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. I think we all like the Psalms. People read them in times of anxiety. People read them in times of joy. There's every possible emotion to be found in the Psalms. But I want to talk this time about the literature of the Psalms. In other words, looking at the Bible poetry as poetry and how it helps us get so much more out of the material that's there and the message that God has for us by knowing literature. So can we go back to Psalm 1 again? So you've heard me read it. What if it was not in a poetic form? What if it's translated and just put in everyday talk? Let me read it to you. I remember what the original says, and read this to you and see what you think. It's good for people if they don't hang around bad individuals. Good people should meditate a lot on God and His law. They will prosper if they continue to do this. But bad people have no depth of character and will eventually be separated from God and righteous people. The future looks better for the righteous than for the wicked. Now, actually, both my version and the original psalm say the same thing. They have the same information they're getting across. But I don't know anybody that would think my version was better. People are going to say, oh, I like the psalm in the Bible. But you know why we like it better is because it has poetic devices that give it power. And so what we're going to do is talk about the literature, of the poetry used in Psalms. So, one more time, Psalm 1. Take a look at that sometime. You can picture it. Do you notice it's set up in lines, isn't it? It doesn't run all the way across the page to the edge and come back. It's set up with short lines. So, for example, in mine, it says, blessed is the man, then there's a jump to a new line, who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, another new line, or stand in the way of sinners, another new line, or sit in the seat of mockers. So let's just take that for a minute. Why is poetry set up by lines as opposed to like reading a newspaper or a short story or something else that just runs from one side to the other side? Doesn't it force you to slow down? It breaks sentences up into chunks, and those chunks are important. Each piece is a separate piece of information being given to us. So, for example, can I go back for those first lines that I just read? Blessed is the man. Now, that's it. Just those that number of words. Blessed is the man. So the focus there is, what do you have to do to be blessed? It kind of teases us, doesn't it? It forces us to go to another line that says, who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. What else does he not do? He does not stand in the way of sinners. What else does he not do? Or sit in the seat of mockers. You notice it forces us to think about walking and standing and sitting as characteristics. Something else I think that the original psalm does is allows us to see things, doesn't it? We can see trees, and we can see water, and we can see fruit, and we can see leaves, and we can see chaff. So these are things that bring it to life. Look at mine one more time. It's good for people if they don't hang around bad individuals. Okay, but do you have any picture in your head of what I'm talking about? They will prosper if they continue to do so. What does it mean, prosper? That's just a word. That's just a fuzzy generalization. That's not a specific illustration, is it? Did you notice also Psalm 1 has some comparisons there that are powerful? What are blessed people like? What are righteous people like? They're like trees planted by streams of water. Oh, that sounds great, doesn't it? if you've got good water source and you plant a tree there, that tree is going to do wonderful things. And this one does. It yields its fruit in season. The leaf doesn't wither. That's good news. That's a bounty when you have a tree like that. One more thing Psalms does, the literature there, it's very concentrated. You can't zip through a psalm like you can if you're reading the Sunday newspaper or reading a short story. And that's good. Poetry is concentrated. It says a lot in a short space, so you've got to slow down to appreciate it. You got to let your mind dwell on some of these things. And then did you hear the repetition that was in there? The wicked are like chaff. They will not stand. Sinners won't be in the assembly of the righteous. Delight is in the law of the Lord. Now, in this delight, on his law, he meditates day and night. And does not walk in the council, does not stand, does not sit. There's that repetition, and that's there for purpose, which we'll get to in just a few minutes. So, my version of Psalm 1 is terrible. Yes, it gets the information across. Yes, it's probably the message God would have for us. But it doesn't lift our spirits. It doesn't intrigue us. It doesn't put us in a sense of awe for what's being expressed at all. No emotional connection there. So what I'd like to do in the next part here is to look at some of the devices of poetry that make it effective, that make it memorable, that make us think about these things. So we're going to use a few terms here, and we'll see them throughout. One thing is imagery. So imagery just means it makes you see it. It's like you're running a movie through your head. You can picture what they're talking about. Let me give you an example from a book that is not used particularly often. People don't preach from it. People don't sit there and say, yeah, I think I'll spend some time this week reading it. It's the book of Nahum. It's in the Old Testament. Let me pick up in Nahum 2 and Nahum 3. And what Nahum is talking about is God being angry with Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. And of course, Assyria was like ISIS in its day. It was frightening. It was horrifying. They did terrible things to prisoners. They were brutal warriors. And so Nahum is so delighted because he's happy that the city is going to fall. And let me give you I won't do all of 2 and 3 and Nahum, but just give you a sense of picturing what he's talking about. He starts off in chapter 2. He says, an attacker advances against you, Nineveh. Guard the fortress. Watch the road. Brace yourselves. Marshal all your strength. And then this verse, chapter 2, verse 3. The shields of his soldiers are red. The warriors are clad in scarlet. He's talking about the soldiers coming in to smash Nineveh. The metal on the chariots flashes on the day they are made ready. The spears of pine are brandished. The chariots storm through the streets, rushing back and forth through the squares. They look like flaming torches. They dart about like lightning. The river gates are thrown open. The palaces collapse. Nineveh is like a pool. Its waters are draining away. Plunder the silver. Plunder the gold. And then chapter 3, woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims, the crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords, glittering spears, many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses. Could you see that? Did you have an image of those things in your head? Could you imagine the shields, the chariots, the movement inside the city, the whip, you could hear the noise, the crack of the whips, the horses, the flashing of the swords. All of that is so powerful, isn't it? Because it's not just a general story. It's putting you there, and it brings it alive. It makes it so personal when you hear things like that. Let me give you one other place that does something similar. It's all through Hebrew poetry, but let's go to Song of Songs. Song of Solomon sometimes is called chapter 2, and this is very different. You know, Nahum is all about blood and thunder and attack and destroy, but Song of Songs is a love poem. And let me give you just the sights and the images that are created here. I'm in chapter 2. talking about the beloved. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. What about him? He has taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I'm faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. And it talks about later on fig trees. It talks about doves. It talks about mountainsides. It talks about foxes, vineyards. And you can just picture this place. It's beautiful. It's sensuous. It's a lovely place for two lovers to be together. That's imagery. That makes you revel in the sights and the sounds and the smells and the taste and the touch of something so that it becomes real for you. Look for that as you're reading the Bible and just let your mind go. Appreciate the smells, the sounds that you hear there. Okay, so that's one kind of device, poetry device, called imagery. Let's look at figures of speech. Okay, they're called figures of speech. You're familiar with them. There are two. One's called a simile and one's called a metaphor. They're different, but they do the same kind of thing. They make comparisons. All right, so that's the important part. They make comparisons. The difference is similes use a word like or as to show you the connection or the comparison. Okay, so let's look at Song of Songs again, right where I was. How is that young man described? Okay, this is chapter 2, verse 3. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover. Do you hear the word like? My lover is like an apple tree. So if you've got a good apple tree, something juicy, something you treasure, something you love, something that gives you shade, that's her love. We might not think about that today. It may not be the way we would talk about a lover, but it works. Look in verse 9 of chapter 2. Same thing, Song of Psalms. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. So can you picture the grace and yet the strength that she's saying this person has? So that's a simile. Psalms has just so many of them. It was a powerful way for the Hebrew people to talk. Let's look at Psalm 42, verse 1. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. So like or as being used there, I want you so badly. It's like a deer that's panting so hot, looking for a stream of water. Can you imagine how that would feel if you're that deer and you discover that? Oh, that'd be the best thing possible. So what's the value of these? Look for them as you're reading. Something is like something else. Something is as something else. Well, it forces you to think about it. It's memorable. It creates an image in your head. And it's a delight to read. They're short. They allow you to meditate on them. They're vivid. And sometimes they're a surprise. So look for similes. Anytime you see a like or an as, things are being compared. Well, I think I already mentioned a metaphor is a comparison as well, but it does not use the like or the as. It just says one thing is something else. So as long as we're in Psalms, let me show you a couple of those. Let's go to Psalm 57:4. It says, I am in the midst of lions. I lie among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. So he says, I'm in trouble here. I've got men that want to get rid of me, dangerous men. And instead of just saying, I've got to watch out for them because they're pretty cruel, he actually makes this comparison. Their teeth are not like. He didn't use the word like. He said their teeth are spears and arrows. He doesn't say the tongues are as sharp as swords. He said the tongues are sharp swords. So can you see the value? Again, it says picture this and slam these two things close together. These teeth of these guys are spears and arrows. Their tongues are sharp swords. These are actually stronger, I think, than similes because it pushes those two items together. Let's do one more. Psalm 84. I just want you to see how many are used and how powerful they can be. Psalm 84, verse 11. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord bestows favor and honor. No good thing does he withhold from those whose walk is blameless. So look at that first part there. Not God is like a sun. He's like a shield. He says the Lord God is a sun and shield. Now, not literally. It is a comparison. God equals is like these things, but think about the power of that. God is the sun to us. The sun is life. People have worshipped the sun forever. We need the sun. The sun brings warmth. The sun brings growth. And like a shield, God is our shield. Can you imagine if you're a soldier going off to war without a shield? You're in big trouble. So those are all metaphors, and there are plenty more. I won't take the time. Psalm 119, 105 is another example. But I love the use of those. Let me share something that's a little more lighthearted, but just give you an idea. I was reading Dilbert a while back, and there was an example of using figures of speech in Dilbert. Now, you all know Dilbert, right? Okay. So the mom walks up to Dilbert, and apparently hasn't seen him for a while, and said, "How's work, Dilbert?" And Dilbert says, "Well, Mom, I'm like a fly stuck in a thick tar of despair. Incompetence hangs in the air like the cold stench of death. I'm drowning, and monkeys dressed as lifeguards are throwing me anvils. My job has convinced me that life is a stale joke with no punchline. I long for the comfort of the grave." Mom says, "Next time, just say it's fine." Dilbert says, "I enjoy our talks, Mom." She says, "It's fine." Okay, well, do you hear those comparisons being made there? I mean, it's obviously for a funny purpose, but I'm like a fly that's stuck. Incompetence is hanging like the cold stench of death. Monkeys are dressed as lifeguards, throwing them anvils. Life is a stale joke. Now, he's obviously morbid and over the hill describing some of these things, but those are figures of speech. Okay, let's take another often used device in Hebrew poetry. What was poetry to them? It was parallelism. Parallelism. So they did not rhyme. If you read the original Hebrew language and read the Psalms, you wouldn't find roses are red, violets are blue, blah, 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 and I love you. They didn't do that. They thought parallelism was a powerful way to construct their language and poetry. Now, we encounter parallelism. We can encounter in some of the most famous speeches given by some of our best speakers. Let me give you an example. Martin Luther King says he doesn't want his children known by the color of the skin of their skin, but by the content of their character. Do you hear that parallelism? I don't want my children known by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. How about Abraham Lincoln? I'm thinking of Churchill. Lincoln says government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Those are three prepositional phrases that he put in a row there for power. Winston Churchill says, never was so much owed by so many to so few, when he was talking about the British flyers during World War II. And so parallelism is a pleasing way to, well, instead of telling you what its value is, let's go to a couple of examples here. Let's do Isaiah, just to be different here. Isaiah chapter 44. Okay, Isaiah 44. I'm going to read 24 to 28. This is what the Lord says, your Redeemer who formed you in the womb. I am the Lord who has made all things, who alone stretched out the heavens, who spread out the earth by myself, who foils the signs of false prophets and makes fools of diviners, who overthrows the learning of the wise and turns it into nonsense, who carries out the words of his servants and fulfills the predictions of his messengers, who says of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited, of the towns of Judah, they shall be built, and of their ruins, I will restore them. Who says to the watery deep, be dry, and I will dry up your streams? Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and will accomplish all that I please? He will say of Jerusalem, let it be rebuilt, and of the temple, let its foundations be laid. You could probably hear that. Can you hear the, it's almost got a repetitive, rhythmic sound to it there. I am the Lord who has made, who has stretched, who has spread out, who foils, who overthrows, who carries, who says, and then the says is repeated toward the end there. So what's the value of that? Well, it's a rhythmic, and people love rhythm. They've always loved rhythm. It's certainly artistic. You can tell it's language that's been shaped, and it forces you to slow down. I think that's probably the main thing. You can't read it like a newspaper article. You're forced to slow down and think about, in this case, in Isaiah 44, think about what God does. And so the slowing down is on purpose. It forces us to meditate. And frankly, it helps with memorization. it'll stick with you more because of that repetition. Let's see parallelism in Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who what? Who does not walk or stand or sit. Okay, what about he's like a tree which yields and the leaf doesn't wither? Therefore the wicked will not stand, nor sinners. The Lord watches over, but the way of the wicked. So sometimes you've got parallelism that includes and increases a particular point, elaborates, and sometimes you've got a contrast. Like verse 6, that's parallelism. The Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So you've got this, but not that. So there you go. There you've got parallelism. It's powerful. Please slow down and enjoy it as you read it. So my conclusion to all of this, poetry to me shows God is an artist. He's allowed his creation, us, to write different kinds of literature in the Bible. Isn't that amazing? I mean, the whole Bible could be one big sermon, but it's not. It has stories, it has poetry, it has letters, it has visionary literature. It's got all sorts of things. God apparently enjoys words. He's an artist. And I hope it makes you feel like you can enter in to the Bible more. It'll, I hope, increase your emotions as you read it. You'll feel a sense of awe, a sense of beauty. I hope you enjoy it a lot. Now, there may be some places that you'd like to go to see this in action a little bit better. Take a look sometime at the Song of Moses and Miriam in Exodus 15. An example of good poetry there. What I think is a lot of fun is look to Judges 4 and Judges 5. You're going to hear the story of Deborah in Judges 4, but in Judges 5, the same events are going to be done in the form of a poem. It's called the Song of Deborah. Now take a look at the differences. I love the song. I think that's actually more fun than the story itself. Look at David's lament for Saul and Jonathan when he finds out they've died in battle. That's 2 Samuel 1. Read David's praise for God's deliverance. That's Psalm 18. Read Jeremiah 6, where he talks about Jerusalem under siege in a poetic form. Chapter 1 of Luke gives us Mary's song. By the way, Luke has a lot of songs. I wonder if he really enjoyed singing. And then Revelation 18 talks about the fall of Babylon. So poetry, I know today is not as popular as it was. Some people dread it. But the Bible is full of it. And we might as well get involved with it and let it do its magic in our lives.